Okay, I want to talk about what this work does to us. Or it does do things to us. And I want to, there's a continuum of responses to this kind of work. And there's three types that I want to look at. The first one is burnout, which you can get not doing this work. It's the mildest of the three. And it's basically a state, as you know, I'm sure, of physical and emotional and mental exhaustion, which comes from long-term involvement in an emotionally draining situation. I mean, you can get burnout from taking care of a disabled child. You get burnout from taking care of a sick parent. You can get burnout from all kinds of things. It's a gradual process. It kind of sneaks up on us. And we get irritable. We get pessimistic. We don't sleep so well. We can't concentrate, and we start to feel apathetic about things that used to really affect us. It is a common occurrence, again, among caregivers of any kind. You know, you can't work with a sort of endless line of needy, broken people and not at least intermittently struggle with burnout. So you should expect it, and you should know how to take care of yourself when you see it, because what you don't want to do is keep moving down the continuum. So it's important periodically to assess where you are, not just in terms of your level of functioning, but internally where you are with the work that you're doing, and your level of emotional exhaustion with what you're doing, and also to look at the particular stressors in your life. You know, we go through seasons in life where we have high stress in our personal lives, which impacts the way we work. Or we have organizational stress. You know, we have difficulty with colleagues, or people are hostile toward you for what you do, or you feel very isolated with what you do, and things like that. So it's just very important to stay self-aware. The second possible response is what we call vicarious traumatization, which is the transformation of a person's internal experience that results from engaging empathetically with another. Because when somebody sits across from you and gives you a trauma story, and you open your heart and have empathy, they have a door in. And I have a colleague that I've known for many years who also does this work, and every once in a while she'll sit down on my couch and she'll say, "I heard something today and it got in. It's under my skin." It's one of those things, and I have things like this in my head. There are moments in working with people where if I pause long enough to think about it, the picture of what happened to them is in my head immediately. Now, there's a whole lot of things I've heard that I can't do that with, but there are some that get in a different way for whatever reason. And so we get vicariously traumatized when those things get in like that. So it can appear suddenly, but VT means that you usually feel overwhelmed by what you're hearing. And you find yourself reacting emotionally in a way that's similar to your clients. You know, you're grieving, you're shedding tears on the way home from work, you're angry, like me banging on the steering wheel. It's something you can't shake when you walk in the door at home, and it sits with you and impacts you at home. You shut down emotionally. You start to feel disconnected from people. I've had various times in my career where I stand in the church and I'm singing and I'm doing whatever everybody else is doing, and I'm thinking, if they only knew what was in my head. Well, that's how survivors think. If they only knew. So we start to feel disconnected. We get a sense of helplessness. You know, we're just so overwhelmed with the stories we're hearing, we feel completely helpless, which, of course, is the way our clients feel. And a lowering of morale. We also can get, I do this, very skeptical. Not so good, but cynical. You know, years ago, I was going to a conference with two colleagues. And we were walking down an airport hallway on the way to the gate. And there was a man in front of us holding hands with a little girl who was probably 4 years old with long blonde hair that was swinging as she walked. And one of my colleagues said, "Oh, she's adorable." And I said, "I wonder if he's abusing her." And then I sort of went like that and realized, uh-oh, Diane, you need to pay attention to yourself. That was a definite sign that I needed to stop and think. So, you know, you think about people, if you do some of this work, you know, you're sitting with incest. You're sitting with rape. You're sitting with physical assault of children. You're sitting with women who are black and blue. You're sitting with combat vets who have war zone stories. You work with these people. You have concern for them. You open your heart to them. You care about them. You may love them. They're dealing with horrific things, and the care and concern that you have and should have for them creates a door to the inside of you. And it gets in. And you can easily find yourself overwhelmed and shut down, and you start mirroring the victim. You start having the same. They feel helpless, you feel helpless. They feel hopeless, you feel hopeless. They feel isolated, you feel isolated. That's vicarious trauma. When you start mirroring them, that's backwards. And you need to pay attention. I have worked, obviously, with these things for decades. I have experienced vicarious trauma many, many times, sometimes for a short time, sometimes for longer. And it can result from the relentless nature of the work. It can happen suddenly through hearing something all of a sudden that gets under your skin. I have sometimes heard a story that got in, and I go home, and we have dinner, and we get ready for bed, and we go to bed, and we go to sleep, and I wake up with a nightmare, and I played the whole memory out in my nightmare. Or sometimes my husband has literally awakened me from sleeping because I'm crying in my sleep. So I have never been traumatized myself, just so you know. But I have been vicariously traumatized many, many times because of bearing witness to the trauma of others. The third and final response on our continuum is post-traumatic stress disorder. You too can catch the disease with which you work. So if you go from burnout to VT and you don't tend to yourself and you keep pushing and you keep absorbing and you don't do anything to take care of yourself, you actually can end up with post-traumatic stress disorder doing this work. It's no longer vicarious. You get to have it all yourself. Not the goal. And so from witnessing and experiencing and being confronted with the extreme traumatic stressors that we sometimes hear about, we start feeling all the same things. You know, we have flashbacks to their stories. We have the sense of helplessness. We do the avoidance thing. We have the startle response and all of that. I've worked with therapists who have gotten to that place. They get on guard all the time. You know, there's a bad guy everywhere you go, like my thing in the airport, but that's all the time. They have flashbacks. They have a sensitivity to sound. They have the startle response. They have mood swings. They have shame. They have tears. They can't sleep and they can't concentrate. Judith Herman said that we catch the disease with which we're working. You cannot do the work like this under the circumstances in which you live and not at least sometimes get emotionally overwhelmed. If it doesn't happen to you, you're not really paying good attention to your clients. So if you never get bothered by some of these things, you never struggle with burnout or VT, then you're not really doing what you're supposed to be doing. But if you do get those things, you need to stop what you're doing and pay attention to yourself and take care of yourself. Repeated exposure to human evil and cruelty will challenge your faith. It should. It heightens your sense of vulnerability. You can easily feel helpless and incompetent in front of some trauma histories. Again, you begin mirroring their helplessness. You may sometimes go through seasons where you just feel like you're in mourning. You know, and sometimes not just for your clients, but for the world. The work, doing this work, will constantly challenge your emotional balance. You'll struggle with wanting to withdraw. One of the ways that therapists sometimes withdraw is they begin to doubt the truth of what their clients tell them. They numb their emotions, or they try to find ways to fire their clients and abandon them because they can't do it anymore. we can easily swing the other way, and we get to the point where we start acting impulsively and start crossing boundaries, and we get messianic, and we're going to rescue everybody because we want to do that, because then we'll feel better on the inside if we do. We can't tolerate the suffering anymore. Some degree of these reactions is inevitable. If we don't have them, we're not doing the work. But we need to monitor. We need people in our lives who help monitor for us, so that we can pay attention to the level at which it's affecting us and get what we need so it doesn't hurt us and our clients. We're hardly infallible, right? So we'll all lose our balance from time to time. Vicarious traumatization. Now, Judith Herman says this. I keep quoting her, so if you haven't read Trauma and Recovery, you will have read half of it by the end of today. Trauma is contagious. In the role of witness, the therapist at times is emotionally overwhelmed. He or she experiences, to a lesser degree, the same terror, rage, and despair as the patient. This phenomenon is known as vicarious traumatization. In addition to suffering vicarious symptoms of PTSD, the therapist has to struggle with the same disruptions in relationship as the patient. Repeated exposure to stories of human rapacity and cruelty inevitably will challenge the therapist's basic faith. It will heighten his or her sense of vulnerability. The therapist shares the patient's experience of helplessness. It is not uncommon for experienced therapists to suddenly feel utterly incompetent and hopeless in the face of a traumatized person. The therapist identifies with the patient through the experience of profound grief. The therapist may feel as though she herself is in mourning. Unless the therapist has adequate support to bear this grief, he or she will not be able to fulfill their promise to bear witness and will withdraw emotionally from the therapeutic alliance. Further down, she says that countertransference, which is our reaction to their stuff, right, has the potential to serve as a guide to understanding their experience. So when I work with my associates and I'm supervising them, somebody came in the other day with a very difficult case, and she said, "I feel completely helpless." I said, "That needs to inform you. That's what your client feels, and you've caught it." Secondary PTSD can assist us to grasp our clients' experiential struggles with abuse. Working with trauma constantly challenges our emotional balance. Like the client, the therapist fights overwhelming feelings by withdrawal or impulsive intrusive action to make it all better so we can both feel better. Examples of withdrawal, again, denial or doubt of the patient's reality. We begin dissociating, or certainly numbing. Minimization of the traumatic material. Really, it really couldn't have been that bad. Professional distancing, abandonment. Examples of intrusive action, rescue attempts, boundary violations, attempts to control the patient. I had a call many years ago from a therapist. Where from? The bathroom in the patient's house. Why was she there? Well, she was there with the patient. Why was she in the bathroom at the patient's house? Well, she'd actually been there all weekend because she was afraid that the patient would kill herself. I said, "You ever heard of 911? But that's what happens. People completely lose their perspective. Or people have patients stay in their homes. I've had therapists call me and say, "I don't know what to do. I had this patient stay in my home so we could sort of show them what a family really should be like, and now these six terrible things are happening." So these things happen. I find my own struggles with wanting to intrude and do more than I should, or wanting to withdraw from time to time. One critical safeguard is a solid support system. You can't do this work by yourself. Unfortunately, many therapists find themselves working with traumatized clients with no support network, either because their work does not provide that, or they're in an organization, and certainly years ago this was true when I first started out, you had an organization that doesn't believe it happens anyway. So you can hardly get good support for how it's impacting you since it never happened. Sometimes there's still some denial in parts of the mental health field, and certainly in the church community. There's been some improvement. But denial of trauma, as we know, is not just something individuals struggle with, it's something systems struggle with. I read a fascinating book many years ago in preparing to go to Rwanda for the first time, which is titled, "We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families," which was a note written by a group of people in a church who went there because the pastor told them they would be safe, but in fact he'd made an agreement with the genocidaires to come in and slaughter them all. It was written by a Canadian named Philip Gurevich, who was a staff writer for The New Yorker. And it's basically his report from the killing fields of Rwanda as I'm sure most of you know, in 1994, one ethnic group basically slaughtered a lot of the other ethnic group, about 1 million people, as well as people of their own group who were protecting people of the other group. There were about 1 million people killed in 100 days, most of them by machete. So again, the book comes from these people or the pastors in this church knowing they were going to be given over to the genocidaires. But he speaks at length about the collective denial of the international community while this atrocity was going on. Some of you have seen Hotel Rwanda. The world and its governments did what most of us do when faced with overwhelming trauma. We pretend it's not happening. The point of this is that it is the natural human response to deny the presence of evil. That's what we want to believe. We don't want to believe that somebody in our family could sexually abuse a child. We don't want to believe that somebody in our church could sexually abuse a child. We don't want to believe that there's a bunch of people running around with machetes slaughtering people that they had dinner with a week ago or go to church with. We don't want to have to think about that. Therapists who bear witness to trauma are not exempt, and it is a very important point, because while we can err on the side of denial or minimization or numbing, we can also err on the side of expecting ourselves to be able to handle any story that is thrown our way and we'll be just fine, thank you. No, we won't. So we have to be realistic, and we're all different. Some of you have more resiliency for this work than others. Some of you will never be called to this work, but you need to understand it so you can recognize it and refer them to the people who do this work. Some of you will do a lot of it. Some of you will struggle in ways others don't. It's okay, but we have to be aware of our tendencies to deny, minimize, or intrude, and the symptoms that we are carrying in ourselves that indicate burnout or vicarious trauma. There's a book by two therapists, last name Sakvitny and Perlman, and they have a workbook called Transforming the Pain, and which is about VT, and they define it this way. It is the transformation, again, of the therapist's inner experience as a result of empathic engagement with another's trauma. So you can either do this work and not have empathy, which in case you'll be a lousy therapist, or you do this work with empathy, in which case you are a therapist at risk. Those are the two options. Vicarious traumatization is an occupational hazard when you work with trauma. And it is not something our clients do to us. It is rather a human consequence of knowing and caring and facing the reality of trauma in the lives of others. Survivors deal with horrific things, and the care and concern you have makes that door. So the impact of VT is determined by the unique interaction between the situation that is being relayed to us by the patient and the person of the helper. So the impact is variable. You may hear a story of horrific trauma and be okay. And somebody else may hear the same story and not want to get out of bed for a week. And you may hear this year and next year hear something that it's equivalent and not be able to handle it. In an unsupported work setting with no support network, or if you have your own personal history of trauma, which many therapists do, the impact will be greater than for other people in other settings. So we have to be aware of the factors that make us vulnerable, and we have to be proactive about seeking support. It is not uncommon for trauma workers to be disturbed by imagery from their clients' stories. These images can come during the day out of nowhere. They can come in nightmares, as I said. They can come during sex. They may be visual, auditory, olfactory, or emotional. They are often hard to talk about. You often have them when it would not be appropriate to talk about them, like at a party or something. And then you think, wow, what do I do with this? And they are frequently disturbing. I had a very astute client years ago who asked me if my brain ever got mixed up about whose memories were in my head. And the answer, yes. So if you're dealing with intrusive images, the first thing you need to do is acknowledge it. You need to tell somebody, because then it quits being a secret. If it's a secret, it replicates the victim. And once it's not a secret, it loses some of its potency. The other thing you want to think about is, why this image? What's the hook in me that made this one stronger and made it stick with me when other images that are just as horrific do not? Does it connect to something personal? Does it raise a vulnerability in me that I don't really want to think about? Does it connect to an old memory of my own? Whatever. What does it trigger in you? What are your emotional responses? I want to hurt somebody. I want to run and hide in a cave. Whatever. What needs in you are threatened by the image? Your need for safety, your need for control, your need to be able to trust, your need for intimacy with people that you love. What can you do to address and lessen your stress level? What do these strategies give you? How do they speak against the trauma? So you need to be active the same way you are for your clients. What are the dynamics of trauma? Loss of voice, loss of connection, loss of a sense of power. So when you start experiencing VT, you need to say, okay, how is it affecting these areas in me, and what do I need to do to move against that? The need is always greater than you can meet. Now, obviously, that's true in terms of the number of survivors in the world, or perhaps the numbers waiting to see you in your practice or something. But it's also true about the individual in front of you. You cannot meet all their needs. You can be the best therapist in the world, and you can't do it. So you have to learn how to bear witness to atrocity, knowing that you are ultimately inadequate. It can easily become overwhelming. So there are some areas of importance that you must tend to if you're going to endure. Self-care, relationships, and faith. You won't last the long haul, nor will you avoid damage to yourself unless you pay attention to them. Now, self-care means, and again, this is the reverse of what abuse does and what our clients struggle with, you have to take care of the body. If you're going to work with stuff like this, they should do this anyway, of course, but you have to take care of the body. You need food and exercise and sleep and recreation. And so those things need to be disciplines in your life that you are consistent with, and if you're not consistent, that you work with, that you have other people who hold you accountable and all those things. You cannot deal with trauma and not take care of yourself. You'll destroy yourself. We tend to end up neglecting our body when people are in crisis and we feel the great need and we don't know what to do and we want to make them feel better and the phone is ringing and all those things. Well, you're mirroring the survivor. The crisis is destroying self-care. You'll break down. Good supportive relationships also are the second thing. They have a tremendous impact on our resiliency and our emotional health. You cannot let yourself be isolated. Now, on the one hand, you don't want to go in and talk to somebody and just dump the memory in their head. Now we have two vicariously traumatized people. It's not the goal. But there are many ways, and I have a group practice. I have 16 associates. I supervise all of them. And for some reason, most of them work with trauma. I'm not sure how that happened. Anyway, but it's interesting as they mature in their abilities to do the work and to take care of themselves and stuff, they begin to monitor themselves much better. So they don't feel like they have to come in and give me all the details about the story. But they say, you know, I'm not going to tell you this part because you don't need it in your head. Thank you, it's pretty full. but they can tell me what it did to them and what their struggle is and all of that. So you don't have to tell exactly the whole story and traumatize somebody else. But you do need to say, somebody told me some really evil stuff today and I'm having a really hard time with it. Here's how it's affecting me. Here's what I've tried to do and it's not working. Here's what I'm, you know, what I need you to kick me in the backside to keep doing. And you can share things about it, just not all of the details for them. So pain and suffering, in any way, isolate us from others. The pain and suffering that you carry from doing this work will isolate you. You'll feel overwhelmed. You need supportive connection with others. It's important to realize that in terms of the cost of empathy, in scope, it is cumulative. So the more you let in, the more you'll be impacted in some ways. It is pervasive, it is contagious, and it is disruptive. So you having empathy, which they probably told you the first day you got into the program, you have to have empathy, here's what it is, here's how to do it. You have to have that to be good, and it opens the door. So what it does then is change your meaning about life. I don't think about God the same way I did 40 years ago. That's good. I don't think about people the same way. That's been hard. I think about things like trust differently than I did. Your worldview. You know, I've not only done this work for 40 years, I've traveled all over the globe and dealt with trauma of all different kinds. I don't really think about the world the way most people do anymore. My identity is different. It's not the same as it was. My faith is different. My imagery system is different because I have stuff in my head that doesn't belong to my life. There are dangers in having empathy in this work. 60% of therapists of trauma have their own trauma histories. 60%. Now, I get that. I have colleagues in my office who have their own trauma histories. They've done the work. You have to do the work. But it gets poked at sometimes. You know, somebody comes in with a really similar story, and it pulls it up again. And so they have to work. But it obviously is often something that woos people into the field because I get it. I understand the suffering. It gives meaning to my suffering. I want you to find what I have found in doing the work. But there's a vulnerability there. And having your own trauma history means you are more vulnerable to vicarious traumatization than somebody else. If you're depleted and needy, that's when you are in danger of crossing boundaries. Because what you want is for them to make you feel better. Now, obviously, that's on a whole continuum. You may sort of manipulate the session so they tell you how wonderful you are, right? Which is not terrible harm done. Or you could have sex with them all the way, whatever. And trust me, I've seen plenty of survivors whose therapists have had sex with them. They're going to show them how to do it right. And they didn't mean to. I mean, they didn't start out planning to do that. But that's what happened. So the danger in having empathy is that we get depleted and needy and we take our neediness to the client, which is completely inappropriate ethically. The other thing that we do is we get misguided about how we're going to rescue people. And I gave you some examples of that before. You know, they come and stay in your home and all those things. Another thing we do is when we get really frustrated with people and their resistance and their ambivalence and their back and forthness and everything else, we label them with really damaging diagnoses, usually borderline, right? So, which is not to say that you won't see people who have borderline personality disorder, but it is often things like that that we sort of throw around because we're frustrated. You know, I'm having trouble with them because they're this. So we need to watch what we do. We use it as a weapon or a justification for wanting to give up or for our despair. So the maintenance of hope when you do this work is something you need to think about. because you want to be grounded in reality that this is a really ruined world full of really ruined creatures who are busily ruining each other, and have hope. It's very easy to become cynical and harsh and judgmental and just despair of humanity. What's the point? You know, you can only keep facing trauma and evil without getting twisted when you have your eyes fixed on the one Redeemer. And we are not He. It is His work to redeem and restore broken humanity. We're just showing up so He can work. And for me, it is my faith and the radical changes in it since I began this work so many years ago that is foundational to what I do. I would have quit long time ago, came very close to quitting 20 years ago. I was just going to walk away because I couldn't get my grounding in terms of hope and redemption, and you know, all I saw was the trash. Evil and suffering have a tremendous capacity to swallow up our faith. And when that happens, we are full of despair. And working with incest and rape and sexual abuse carries evil and darkness and chaos and isolation and to despair into your empathetic soul. And then you got to figure out what to do with it once it's in there. It is crucial that you find ways to think about that, to counteract that. Years ago, when I was close to giving up, I sat down one day and I had a list, and I wrote on one side of the paper, I just thought I was going to write one list, actually. I ended up writing two. But anyway, on the one side of the paper, chaos, darkness, evil, you know, whatever. I just list. This is the menu of what I do every day. I'm sitting there looking at that and thinking, no wonder you want to quit. And then I thought, which I know was from the Spirit of God, what's the opposite? What's the antidote? Chaos, order, ugly, beauty, darkness, light, evil, good. Who's this? God. And I realized at that moment that the only way I would survive this was if I constantly sought the antidote for each one in a disciplined way. So, chaos, me, I like Bach. When you get to the point where you think there's no order in life, you listen to Bach. Ugly? My husband and I hike in the woods. I love the beauty. Learn the birds, learn the trees, learn the flowers. Just see the little things and know whose hand made them. Disconnection? My husband, my kids, my grandkids, my colleagues and friends. Those relationships over the last 20 years since that point have made all the difference in the world. They are the earthy things that demonstrate the antidotes that are rooted in the character of God Himself. And if I don't drink from that well on a daily basis, I will drown in this well and quit or hurt people. The other thing that I have done for many, many years is get up early in the morning and sit in the chair, as my colleagues call it, and read and study the scriptures and for a good hour every morning. I like a lot of really dead theologians. You know, the old Scottish guys and all those kind of people. I read stuff like that a lot. But it has been, it's some of the old theologians who really know the scriptures and the character of God, but they also get human beings. You know, you don't often get that combination. So I've been soaking in those things for a long time. We were created as image bearers. God made us in His image. If we're going to be in the image of something, that means that who we are inherently has to have the capacity to bear an image. So I believe that because we're image bearers, and it's part of our nature to bear an image, that we are malleable. You can't bear an imprint of something or an image of something unless it can affect you. So if you sit with trauma long enough, you'll bear the image of trauma in your person, in your soul. We are impacted with what we habitually sit with. I have been profoundly impacted by my own struggles with this work and by the fact that as I walk through the trauma of my clients and I live with the impact of it on their lives and on mine, that I am following in the footsteps of my Savior. It's not a road he wasn't on. It is the road he took. He became flesh and entered into our trauma. You don't think evil's traumatizing to a soul? That's the greatest trauma that there is. He literally took that on himself, and he has gone before us. So you think about some of the aspects of vicarious traumatization. It affects our identity. His was eternally altered. He was God, he became man. It damages connection. He was one with God, and he left heaven and came here. Trauma overwhelms us with strong feelings. My soul is sick unto death. I am distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow. It affects our sense of safety. He went to hell. That's about as unsafe as you can get. Paul says in Colossians 1:24, I find joy amid my sufferings for you, and I fill up in my person whatever is lacking in Christ's afflictions on behalf of his body, the church. And in 2 Corinthians, he talks about his ministry to others, and he repeats the principle. If I endure affliction, it is for your comfort. As we sit with the trauma of others and feel it reverberate throughout our persons and our lives and our souls, let us remember that there is nothing that Christ has called us to do that he has not undergone first. Nothing. And in doing as he did, we bring his comfort and healing to those whose lives are damaged by the evil of others. About 1 month after 9/11, I was invited to New York to speak at a conference on trauma. And during my stay there, I was taken to Ground Zero overnight until about 3 or 4 in the morning, and then had to get up and speak the next morning, to spend the night among the workers who were digging for bodies that didn't exist. The ground was still hot. And I got in a taxi about 3 or 4 in the morning, and there was a man in there. I don't normally in New York get into taxis that have men other than cab drivers in them, but he had been a worker, and everybody did things differently at that point. So I got into the taxi with him. He was an iron welder, and he did not have any idea what I did for a living, and he never asked me. But I asked him, classic psychologist, about his experiences at Ground Zero. So he told me that he lived in North Jersey, and he heard what had happened, and he did what a lot of people did. He showed up to see what he could do to help. So he arrived on the first day, and they gave him trash bags, and they said, go and walk the circumference and pick up body parts. That's what he did. His father had been a Vietnam vet. Well, I've worked with lots of Vietnam vets. They have a place in my heart. And it had terrible post-traumatic stress disorder, and as many have been, was a raging alcoholic. So he grew up bearing his father's terrible rage and swore he would never do that to his own family. So he said to me, you know, a lot of the workers leave here at night, and they leave the pit and they go get drunk because they can't cope with what we've had to do. But he refused. So he spent the night in a cab, and the cab drivers wouldn't charge him, having them drive him around the city before he would go home when the sun was rising. So they dropped me off at my hotel, and the cab driver was going to drive him around the city. So I'm getting out of the cab at my hotel, and he took my hand and stopped me before I left. And he said, lady, I refuse to drink away what I have seen, but can you tell me, ma'am, what am I supposed to do with these memories? What am I supposed to do with these memories? You think about the memories of the workers around the world, whether it's, you know, people working with Ebola or missionaries or people working with trafficking victims or whatever. You think about your memories. You're a caregiver. Even if you don't do trauma work, you've heard stuff you really wouldn't want to know about if you had a choice. The things that people do to each other, the cruelty, the viciousness in some divorces, the lack of care for children in the midst of those fights. Many of you have memories that you really wish you didn't have, and they're not yours, they're somebody else's. And the trauma, the suffering is contagious. If you sit with trauma long enough, you too can be traumatized. And if you don't answer the question that that iron welder asked me, those memories will poison you over time. Those God has called to bear witness to human suffering pay a price, and the most effective caregivers are the most vulnerable to the contagion effect. Because the greater your capacity for feeling and expressing empathy, the more at risk you are for developing secondary trauma. The process of attending to trauma is traumatic. You develop a sense of great helplessness, sometimes confusion and disorientation because the world is sure not the way you thought it was going to be. You feel isolated from others because of the images that you carry in your minds. Do not neglect yourselves. If you do this work and you've been called by God, again, it doesn't just have to be with trauma, but whatever you're doing, you're working with suffering. If you neglect yourself, you will destroy yourself and not be able to do what God has called you to do, or you will damage others who have already been gravely wounded. The one being who endured the greatest trauma ever known, our Savior, is eternally scarred. You're not going to do this work without getting scarred. There's no suffering that we bear witness to that he has not borne. But in bearing such things, he is marred for all eternity. See my hands? See my side? We who are far more frail and finite cannot expect to confront the litter of hell in others' lives and not get scarred. He has called us to be actively part of his redemptive work in this world. He has called us to go to the places of disease and death and darkness. Having called us, he does not abandon us. I know. He goes with us and in us. He will comfort and equip us and strengthen us and pray for us. And we need to go because a body that does not follow its head is a sick body. And our head went into these places and we are his body. So we must go. Any servant of Jesus Christ that fails to go is not following his or her head. When the church fails to go into these places, the body is not following its head. And many servants of Christ have suffered needlessly and been dropped by the wayside because of the failure of the body to follow its head into the places of darkness and evil. Jesus was a cross bearer. He leads in the way of suffering and sorrow. He does not abandon. It's my prayer that you will never abandon his work of caring faithfully and praying perpetually for those that you work with and those around the world who have been abused and oppressed and abandoned. I want to close by giving you three elements that I think are absolutely necessary if we are to do this work and do it well. The first is you need to know about people. It's part of what today's been about. That's what your degrees are about. You need to understand trauma. You need to understand what trauma does to human beings. And yet, having learned, you need to never assume you know. No matter how many victims you see, everyone is unique. And if you do not understand that, you will make wrong judgments and hurt people. You will prematurely expect change because the three people before them did it that way. And they're not doing it that way. You will give wrong answers, and you will fail to hear and understand and see them, as my Rwandan friend said, because you think you already know. So listen acutely. Study humans avidly. The second thing you need is you need to know God. Not just hear. You need to know him. You need to know his word. You need to be an avid student of that word. If you're going to be his representative in the treatment room, you probably ought to know something about him. We're very presumptuous, I think, sometimes, and we speak for him and we don't really know him at all. We need to be so permeated by his word that we actually learn to think his thoughts. George MacDonald said this, "If you say the opinions I hold and by which I represent Christianity are those of the Bible, I reply that none can understand, still less represent the opinions of another, but such as are of the same mind with him." May we never forget that to know his word according to him means that it is woven into our lives and we are obedient to it. Where we do not obey his word, we do not know him. And finally, do not do this work, or any other for that matter, without utter dependence on the Spirit of God. I mean, really, where do you think you're going to find wisdom? How are you going to know when to speak and when to keep your mouth shut? How are you going to discern lies from truth? You think you have that figured out? How are you going to love somebody when you're tired or be patient when you're weary? And how are you going to know the mind of God apart from the Spirit of God? How can we possibly think, whether it's in our homes, with our kids, with our spouses, in our churches, or in the therapy room, that we can be somebody who demonstrates the character of God apart from the Spirit of God? And how can we think that the life-giving power of the work of Jesus Christ crucified is going to be released into other lives by our presence there unless we've allowed that cross to do its own work in our lives? To work with sexual abuse is to work with lies, darkness, and evil. It is hell brought up from below Earth's surface. You cannot fight the litter of hell in a life apart from utter dependence on the Spirit of God. You cannot bring life to dead places unless you walk dependent on the Spirit of God. This is a work that I can say is a great privilege and honor to do. It is a work that is very difficult to do. I still find it difficult. The task of learning to serve as an image bearer of God, a representative somehow of his character in the flesh, so that the seen accurately represents the unseen, so that it can be understood by someone who never saw it before, grasped in some small measure, is far beyond my capability or yours. But it is a work, if you will let it, that will take you continually to your knees with a heart that's slammed up against a wall and doesn't know what to do, but is hungry for more of God in that place so that you can turn and bring his presence in very concrete ways into places and corners and lives where he has never yet been known. Thank you.